CMC Markets is a pioneering CFD and spread betting provider. With more than 30 years of experience, CMC Markets provides traders with the tools they need to trade confidently. 76% of retail investor accounts lose money.
Welcome to the City View podcast in partnership with CMC Markets. I'm Andy Sylvester, acting editor of City AM, and we'll launch right into the news, analysis, and interviews that you need for the week ahead in the city. Hello and welcome to the City View podcast in partnership with CMC Markets. I'm Andy Sylvester, acting editor of City AM. In a minute, we'll be joined by Poppy Wood, City AM's coronavirus expert, and we'll look back at the week just gone and perhaps the reaction to Big Pharma over the past year and how that's changed the reputation of a whole industry. We'll then talk to Michael Houston, Chief Markets Analyst at CMC Markets, about the week to come, including US job figures, and then this week's special guest, Cisco UK's CEO David Meads. Poppy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's been quite a week again in the world of COVID-19 vaccine politics. An almighty row within the European Union and with the UK, stockpiles of vaccines or maybe not stockpiles of vaccines being impounded, etc., etc. Where have we got to at the end of the week as we, you know, approach the weekend?
So the latest update on the ongoing row between the UK and the EU around vaccines, but also specifically about the AstraZeneca vaccine, is that we've sort of agreed to have a civil discussion with the EU on the best move going ahead. So the UK still hasn't sort of reached an agreement on what to do with these vaccine doses. Ursula von der Leyen, President of the European Commission, is still demanding that we share some of our vaccine doses with the EU because they're so behind. So the UK have vaccinated more than 50% of adults, or offered a first dose of the vaccine to more than 50% of adults, whereas the EU have vaccinated just over 11% of their adult population. So they're really behind. Von der Leyen is demanding that, you know, we reach an agreement where we can give some of our doses made in the EU to the EU rather than shipping them back to the UK. And last night she tweeted quite furiously that, you know, the EU had exported all these doses to the UK and we haven't sent back any in return. So discussions are still ongoing. We still haven't reached a solution, but it looks like we're on the right track.
Well, that's good news. I think, you know, it's one of those where you look at the politics of it and it's impossible not to get caught up in this sort of, like you said, the race. But actually, you know, for the UK economy and for European economies, which are basically interconnected, you kind of need all parts to thrive, or you know, there will just be weaknesses across the piece. Thinking more broadly about sort of the last year, I suppose, you wrote a brilliant piece for us this week as we all look back on a year of lockdowns and opening up and a year of COVID, so to speak. And you were writing about the reputation of Big Pharma. Now, in February of last year, there weren't too many industries that got as much flack as Big Pharma did, you know, be it in the UK or the US or further afield. That's changed, obviously. AstraZeneca giving out the vaccine for, you know, at cost, Pfizer moving through the vaccine process so quickly, and BioNTech and various others. Is Big Pharma sort of set for what's the premise of your piece for those people who are yet inexplicably to read it?
You're right. So Big Pharma, you know, up until the pandemic really was quite a dirty word, and it was seen as one of the most hated industries in the world. All these polling firms noted that in 2018, 2019, it was the most hated industry in the US and the most hated healthcare sector in the world. Because of all these scandals, you know, the opioid epidemic in America, lots of price gouging scandals. There was that famous case of Martin Shkreli, whose firm, Turing Pharmaceuticals, bought the license for an antiparasitic drug and hiked the price by 5,000%. And he was dubbed Pharma Boy, and he really came to represent an industry that had sort of seen its golden era wane. And then comes along the pandemic, and, you know, the way out of it is science. A year later, we have produced a vaccine, which is unheard of. People are being vaccinated all over the world. Normally, vaccines take 10 years from start to finish, and it's happened such a short space of time that, you know, credit where credit's due. Big Pharma has really seen its renaissance from pharmaceuticals firms being quite, you know, have a bad reputation strung along with them. Now AstraZeneca, Pfizer, BioNTech, they're all household names. And they have seen, you know, their glory day come again. But that said, going forward, you know, at the moment, AstraZeneca aren't making a profit off their vaccine. They've agreed to give it at cost price during the pandemic. Pfizer have decided to make a profit off it, and they've so far said that they're going to make $15 billion off it this year. I think going forward, whether they can sort of consolidate that reputation that they've garnered through the pandemic is, it will be on a cost basis, first and foremost. So will they suddenly hike up the price after the pandemic? When do we decide the pandemic's over? I think that's up to the World Health Organization to officially declare it over, but that can take a very long time, or a very short time. It really depends on the nature of the virus. But also, as we've seen in Europe, whether pharmaceuticals firms can cement their reputation really is kind of out of their hands at the moment. So AstraZeneca was hailed as this bright light of the pandemic, and still is in the UK, for rolling out the vaccine so quickly. But because the vaccine rollout's had so many hiccups on the continent, it's seen its name dragged through the mud once more.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see how it's going to change across, as you say, the two different sides of the channel, because I think, you know, in this country, you'll have kids that realise they're not very good at football suddenly deciding that their dream job is to be a vaccine scientist. But in Europe, you know, they are still looking at AstraZeneca with a degree of scepticism. So it will be interesting to see where it goes. It'll be interesting to see what that means for investors, for investment, and also political regulators, and what they, where they go with their kind of approach to big pharma. Poppy, cheers for joining us as ever.
Thank you.
And we are now joined, I'm glad to say, by Michael Hewson, Chief Markets Analyst at CMC Markets. Michael, always a pleasure to have you on.
Yes, good morning, Andy. How are you?
Oh, not bad at all. All jabbed. I think the pair of us have both had our jabs, so we're well on our way to recovery.
Yes, yes, indeed. I had mine a couple of days ago, and I have to say I'm still feeling it a little bit, but certainly better now than I was this time yesterday.
Well, welcome news. And speaking of COVID recovery, see what I did there. Let's start on the other side of the Atlantic, because Friday, the 2nd of April, Good Friday of all days, we have US non-farm payrolls, basically the job stats for the US, which are always closely watched. But what's your impression of where the city's expecting the US economy to go this year? Because obviously, you know, as a country, and it differs state by state, of course, but as a country, a slightly different approach to COVID, more open throughout Q1 and presumably more open through Q2 and various, you know, and onwards.
Yeah, I mean, the glide path for the US recovery continues to get adjusted upwards. I mean, I think depending on who you talk to, the GDP target for this year varies anything between 6% and 9%. And certainly, I think in terms of the jobs market recovery that we've seen this year, that would appear to be a fairly credible estimate. If we look at what happened in January, we saw job gains of 166,000. That was a revised number. And then in the February numbers, we saw 379,000. Let me cast your mind back to the end of last year, where there was a negative print of 227. So I think the combined effect of the stimulus checks at the end of last year, $900 billion, and then the additional $1.9 trillion that was only signed off a couple of weeks ago would appear to suggest that expectations from March are much higher. I've got penciled in 600,000 jobs to be added. And let's not forget also that we have the ADP payrolls report as well, which comes out on the Wednesday, which is also likely to be a leading indicator. That comes against a backdrop of some weekly jobless claims data that dropped below 700,000 at last time of asking. That's the best number since the pandemic lockdowns.
Mm. Yeah, it's fascinating to see kind of the sheer scale of these moves. It really is, and you see, I guess, in some way, you see obviously the US job market distinctly more flexible than it is in any kind of European context. But you know, a lot of commentators, I don't know if you're among them, Michael, saying getting almost a little bit edgy about that rapid rate of recovery when you look at the Fed keeping interest rates where they are potentially until, you know, 2024. Do you think the Fed's getting the balancing act right for now?
For now, it's managing expectations fairly well. If you look at the US 10-year, that's around about 1.67%, give or take. It's off its highs of the year. Nonetheless, I think a big acid test will be on the 2-year. At the moment, short-term interest rate expectations are well anchored. So what's happening is the movement in the yield curve is happening at the long end. It's not happening at the short end. The Fed will have a problem if the 2-year yield starts to come out of the range that it's been in for the past 6 months to a year, where it's traded between 0.1 and 0.15%. So it's getting the balance right at the moment. The big test will be in Q2 if non-farm payrolls numbers start to consistently, you know, bring in numbers of around about 700,000, 800,000, 900,000 a month, because the US economy is still well below the levels of employment that it was a year ago. There's still around about 9 million jobs that it still needs to put back in.
Plenty more to go. Let's jump back to the UK. We've got, you know, one of those companies. We've got Next with full year results on Thursday for 2020. Obviously closely watched in any year as a bellwether of the high street, more so probably this year, despite the fact it's been such an odd, you know, 12 months. But when you look at Next, and when you look at more generally, Britain seems to, or the British government seems to be relying on a consumer boom as the way to back towards economic recovery in the UK. Where do you see with Next, and what's your feeling on that, you know, the savings splurge for the summer?
I think it's a credible narrative, and certainly I think Mr. Haldane has got the right idea when he suggests that we could see a little bit of, you know, pent-up demand, shall we say. Whether or not it's as much as he thinks it is another question. Certainly if you look at Next's share price, it's back above the levels that it was pre-pandemic, and certainly in terms of its quarterly numbers, it has actually managed to adapt fairly well to the new paradigm of online shopping. If you compare to the sales numbers that it had to pick out, say, from a year ago, where sales were clobbered by 52% as a result of the March lockdown, and where full price sales dipped only by 1.1% for the 9 weeks until the 26th of December, even though its shops have been closed, it has been able to adapt its business model to reflect the move to online. And that's certainly reflected in its share price. And yes, it's had to downgrade its profit forecasts for the full year from the end of last year because of the January the 6th lockdown. But nonetheless, they still reckon the profit forecast around about £342 million. Well, that's not too shabby for a shop that's seen most of its stores shut for around about 50% of the year.
Not too shabby indeed. Let's leave it there on an optimistic note. Not many times over the past year I've been able to do that. So, Michael, thanks for bringing some joy to our lives today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Andy.
And from Michael, we will turn to this week's special guest. David Meads is the chief executive of Cisco in the UK and Ireland, with direct responsibility for Cisco's sales operations in the region, and obviously overseeing a diverse community of employees and working with businesses right across the UK economy. David, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Andy.
Oh, pleasure. I think probably the best place to kick off, and we'll whistle around a few issues, but the best way to kick off is probably if you could give us a quick steer on Cisco's kind of role in the UK and what the sort of priorities are, because I think everybody's familiar with Cisco as a, you know, big old global operator, but what is it about the UK side of things that's particularly sort of taking up your inbox?
Where to start, Andy? So maybe a little bit for the listeners about our footprint in the UK. So I mean, many people will know Cisco is a large US tech company. Globally, about 80,000 people. We actually celebrated our 30-year anniversary in the UK in December, a couple of months ago. So we've been around for a long time. We've got just over 3,000 employees across the UK, about 20 offices up and down the UK and Ireland. And from a London perspective, we have 9 offices across London. Whilst people may have some recognition on Cisco, we're not a consumer brand. You know, we don't sell to the consumer. We're a business-to-business model, businesses large and small alike. So from very small SMEs to the very largest banks and multinationals across the UK and across the globe for that matter. And of course, public sector, government's also a big marketplace for us as well. And I guess the commonality across those businesses, you know, whether you're small or large, and to try and put it in non-technical terms, I think one thing that this pandemic has done is accelerate the way in which companies have had to look at their use of technology and the perhaps overused term of digital transformation. But that's becoming very real for many organizations. And, we look at that in four parts, although every business will be different. I think the four areas of commonality are around applications and how organizations are looking at applications as the way in which they interact with their customers. So reimagining applications in a post-pandemic world, how they empower their teams. So that's really around collaboration technologies that we've all become very familiar with in the last 12 months in particular. Most companies, again, large and small, but particularly the larger organizations, are looking at their infrastructure and how they transform their infrastructure to accelerate the digitization. And a lot of that calls into question, what does cloud mean? So there's a large area there, and security, of course. I mean, that was critical pre-pandemic. It's become even more critical because as everybody's been working from home, then there's a lot more vulnerability for organizations, large and small. So those are the kind of four areas that I think are common across all of our customers, regardless of whether they're small or large.
I guess that, as you've mentioned, that B2B element of it and supporting small and large businesses, it's a funny thing to say, you obviously got insight into the tech industry because the tech industry is just the economy now. But I guess, with your insight on the wider sort of UK tech industry, I suppose, and I don't mean just, really cool fintechs, sort of the broader kind of shift towards digital. What have been the sort of key things you've noticed over the past 12 months? You mentioned the sort of quite aggressive shift towards it, but what are the speed bumps that people have found on the way to a slightly more digital way of doing business?
I did mention it, and it's that word cloud again. And it's worth unpacking this for a few minutes, Andy, because I think there's a common perception that organizations are shifting everything to the cloud. And that's certainly true that many organizations are looking at public cloud and, what are the economics of public cloud and what are the implications from an agility or a security perspective? But when you start to unpack it, it's not a case of, let's move everything to the cloud. What we're seeing is that organizations are looking at what we call a hybrid world. So what I mean by that is, yes, it makes sense for us to move certain applications to the public cloud, both economically and from general business principles. But it also makes sense that we keep a lot of our IPR in what we would call the private cloud. So it's a hybrid world of both public and private. And I think where that plays to the likes of a Cisco is being able to help companies who can navigate to private and public. So we're not a public cloud provider. We don't have a public cloud, but we do provide insights for people to be able to make decisions around what makes most sense for them. Is it public or private cloud? So that's an ongoing discussion that's probably relevant with every customer that we're speaking with.
It's fascinating stuff, and I think, as I say, that kind of that vision of where people are going from your perspective is so interesting when people talk about the shift to digital, and it can be such a catch-all term. I suppose going forward then, do you see those trends continuing, or is it sort of back to where we were, or do you think people have kind of made the leap now and just accept that this is the new world order and are going to have to keep going down that path?
Yeah, no question in my mind. I think it's a change that's for the long term. I think it's broken through a lot of glass ceilings that people had before, misconceptions around what technology could and couldn't do, what were the restrictions and capabilities. And I think what this has proven is that through necessity, actually technology can provide a lot more flexibility. And then when you look at how you are more relevant in this world, if you don't have a tech strategy, then you are risking being less relevant to the consumer and to the end user customer. So I think that it's here to stay. And I think the acceleration we've seen, there's anecdotes that you hear about from various people in the in the media, that digital transformation that perhaps would have taken 2 or 3 years has accelerated in 2 or 3 months now. And I don't think that's that's an exaggeration. And I think in particular in the public sector, if you look at the various parts of a public sector, be it central government, be it education services, healthcare services, my own view is that that's where we've really seen this glass ceiling smash through for the good, and that we'll now see technology become more embedded in how those services are delivered from here on in.
Yeah, I think I'm inclined to agree, particularly on that public sector point. I mean, you know, those were, I mean, these are still very large organizations which have been historically quite difficult to move forward when it comes to just basic infrastructure, because you start digging into them and you realize that it's all been put together sort of piece by piece, and that unpicking it becomes almost more of a danger than it is worthwhile advancing it. But that attitude seems to have gone this year. And I guess looking a bit more into the future as well, and we talk about the recovery, there are, unsurprisingly, you, probably me, big advocates for you know, employing ever more complex and interesting technology. But we hear a lot about the digital divide. That will come across, of course, in the recovery. How do you, at Cisco, how are you looking at the future of technology and making sure it is inclusive, you know, to all, and it isn't just, you know, those that can get it and those that understand it that can thrive and prosper from it?
Yeah, it's a great question and a very topical one, Andy. I think there's, in my mind, it's kind of two domains here. One is the access to connectivity. So, you know, there is the digital divide in its rawest form. And of course, last week we saw the government launch Project Gigabit and £5 billion investment into trying to provide connectivity and super fast connectivity to those areas where, you know, they either don't have connectivity or it's very slow. So I think that's a massive leap forward, and you know, we'll see the benefits of that over the next couple of years. But that's kind of half the story. The other half of the story, in my view, is digital skills, and that's where we still have a major shortage, which predates the pandemic. In all honesty, it's not something that's come about just because of the acceleration of digitization. But and that's where I think we have the opportunity to really, you know, cast the net much wider. If you look at the demographic of you know, tech skills, it's predominantly male. There's not enough females in technology. I think there's something that we all collectively as an industry have to work on there. I think in terms of people who live in more socially deprived areas, I think we can be more inclusive in trying to attract and promote STEM and technology to those areas. So there's a huge amount that we can do, and I think it is a combination of government and private sector, and I think it's also a combination of the tech sector and the users, you know. So you know, the big users of tech as well have a key role to play here.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I just want to pick up and dig in a bit. You talked about casting the net wider in terms of the people that go into these roles. You was a, you know, employer of 3,000 people in the UK, obviously in need of tech skills. Two-part question, really. One, what's your assessment of the talent that's available to you in the UK right now compared to your needs? And two, you know, do you see any of that changing in the future as a result of, you know, the B word and the changes to immigration that will come about just by the nature of leaving the European Union?
Yeah. Firstly, from our perspective, there's a couple of things that we're you know, doing to try and move the needle, both for our own business, but also for the industry. So we're big sponsors of the apprenticeship program, which we've been now, I think this is our eighth year of apprentices, and we had our highest intake this year on any previous year. That's a big needle mover because the demographic that we bring in, it's very diverse across the full spectrum of diversity, both gender, but also, you know, color of skin, religion. So that's a huge needle mover. And I'm hopeful that there'll be continual evolution of the apprenticeship levy, which was kind of alluded to in the budget speech, which will help us to, you know, invest more into that. So that's one area. But I guess on a broader scale, we have a Network Academy program, which is not new. That's, in fact, it's 1999, I think, when we first developed the Network Academy program. What that is effectively we provide curriculum, we provide training, and we work with public and private sector across the globe In the UK, I think we have in excess of 300 networking academies and in excess of 30,000 students who are going through those academies on an annual basis, and that's growing double digit every year. What the academy provides is an option of different curriculums, from sort of basic IT essential skills to industry recognized certifications around, you know, Cisco technology, but other technologies as well, cybersecurity, IoT, data analytics, and the like. So the fact that the intake to those network academies is growing at the rate that it's growing suggests to me that there is the demand, and that people are increasingly looking at tech as an industry and as a career option. But, you know, one program in and of itself is not going to solve the shortage of skills that we have across the UK. It's going to take, as I say, industry and government working together. I do think, you know, in terms of, you mentioned the B word, Brexit, I think was the B word you were alluding to. I do think we have an opportunity to become, you know, a leading force in the tech industry. And I think that, you know, that Boris Johnson has alluded to exactly that ambition, that we want to be, you know, a leader in tech, not just across Europe, but across the globe. And I think that we have the potential to do that. There's a huge amount of innovation that's going on across the UK in the area of tech.
And can we do that even with more strict, I suppose, standards, for want of a better phrase, more strict regulations on who can and who can't work in the UK in terms of, you know, just people moving from the continent to the UK? Is the tech visa, as it's talked about, enough for you?
I don't want to get into you know, what might be a policy decision. I don't think that's going to be a gating factor. I think there's more than enough talent within the UK that you know, we can fulfil that ambition. But of course, you know, that could well include EU nationals as well. But I don't think we'd be dependent on that talent. I think there's plenty of talent across the UK.
Mm. And just looking forward, obviously, it talks about the cloud and talking about the technological side of things and where the UK might be in a few years' time. One of the things that the UK will need to be a leader in tech, or leader in, you know, businesses adopting new ways of using tech, will be the digital infrastructure. You know, for my money, broadband is, you know, the fourth utility, or whatever you want to call it, and probably needs some work on about, you know, ensuring universal access, et cetera, et cetera. But let's look at two sort of newer technologies that the UK is chasing, 5G and Wi-Fi 6. 2020, from the people I've spoken to, kind of seems like it's not 5G development back, just because of the nature of a global pandemic. Forget about decisions around Huawei, et cetera. What does that mean for sort of 2021 and the future? How quickly do you think those technologies come on stream in a way that, you know, we can start to sort of see it as standard rather than the exception, which I think it probably is right now?
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating one to see how it's going to play out. And it was interesting, just last week, you'll have seen, of course, there was the latest round of 5G spectrum auctions from government. The general synopsis of that seems to be that there was an expectation that there would be you know, more money raised from those auctions than there was raised. So that may beg the question as to, if the big providers aren't investing so much in that frequency, you know, is it because, you know, they don't see the demand happening as quickly as some industry bystanders may? So I don't know on that. I'm not smart enough to have a view. But what I do believe is that it absolutely is a case of 5G and Wi-Fi 6 technologies coexisting. And I think that will depend on lots of variables, not least of all, you know, large urban conurbations probably lend themselves more easily to the likes of Wi-Fi 6 than more rural areas, where perhaps 5G might be better spent. And a great example, if you think about, you know, particularly for your listeners, last year we announced with Canary Wharf Group the first ever open roaming Wi-Fi 6 solution across Canary Wharf. And, you know, because the demographic of Canary Wharf lends itself so well to that technology. So the idea now is that, you know, if you are a worker in Canary Wharf or a resident in Canary Wharf, you can move around that area freely, moving seamlessly and invisibly to, you know, from one access point to another, and have Wi-Fi 6 capability wherever you go. And you know, if you think about the rest of London, there's no reason why that couldn't be as applicable across all of London. But then when you move to more rural areas, is it as feasible? Well, maybe not. Maybe 5G is going to be a better solution there. So it's going to be fascinating to see how it plays out. But, you know, the general data would suggest that it's not going to be as quick as perhaps we were thinking a year or two ago.
Mm. And does that have an impact on the UK's sort of global competitiveness, or has that slowdown been something that's been seen right across the world? Because obviously the pandemic has been, as we all know from trying to book holidays, a global issue.
I don't think it will affect our competitiveness. Naturally, with new technologies, you see parts of Asia are early and first adopters. But that's not just around 5G. That's been the case for several decades now. I think that's just a general theme. They're very tech hungry part of the world. But generally across the globe, I don't think the UK is lagging behind other major economies in terms of rolling out high speed technology. Far from it. I think the Project Gigabit announcement last week is testament to that.
Mm. Well, I mean, that's an optimistic note to end on, I suppose, David. Thank you so much for joining us. I think it's been interesting to kind of get a steer on what you're up to on this sort of day to day, as well as what the future might look like for the UK. We'll come back to you in a couple of years' time, and we'll hold you to these predictions.
Look forward to it.
For now, David, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Andy.
And that's all from us at the City View with CMC Markets. Do join us next week. We will be approaching Easter and indeed approaching beer gardens being open once again, something we can all look forward to. Thanks again. Bye-bye. That was the City View podcast in partnership with CMC Markets. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. And in the meantime, all the news, analysis and opinion you need will be on cityam.com.
CMC Markets is a pioneering CFD and spread betting provider. With more than 30 years of experience, CMC Markets provides traders with the tools they need to trade confidently.
76% of retail investor accounts lose money.